Philippa Gregory is a British academic who's used her background in history to write romantic historical novels, many set in the Tudor period. In 2002, her first Tudor novel, The Other Boleyn Girl, became a bestseller and was subsequently adapted for BBC television. Now it's a movie starring Scarlett Johansson and Natalie Portman. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Anne Boleyn is the subject of countless books, plays, movies, and ballads, and well, she should be. She wasn't just a party to the end of a royal marriage, but to the beginning of a religious denomination, a shift that triggered one of Britain's bloodiest schisms. She's been portrayed as a shrewd hussy, a thoughtful heroine, and now, in The Other Boleyn Girl, a bit of both. But in the end, the Anne of Natalie Portman is a feminist victim, not an innocent, but still a pawn of arrogant and overweening males, her power illusory, her final solace the loyalty of her enduring sister Mary, played by the movie's other American it girl, Scarlett Johansson. The Other Boleyn Girl has a novel take that the ambitious Boleyn patriarchs pimped out these sisters for the sake of power and prestige. And I know that that phrase got MSNBC news commentator David Schuster suspended a few weeks back, but I'm not talking about the same family. And by the way, Schuster was lucky. If it had been England under Henry VIII, he'd have been suspended from a gallows. At the instigation of her covetous uncle and father, Anne comes close to bewitching King Henry, played by Eric Bana, but makes the mistake of looking more proficient on a horse than he does. So it's Mary, a dewy newlywed, who becomes his mistress, while Anne, livid with jealousy, hatches a plot to flash her dark eyes at the monarch and then refuses him, driving him into a libidinous frenzy. Directed by Justin Chadwick, from a script by Peter Morgan, who wrote The Queen, The Other Boleyn Girl is, historically speaking, balderdash. It has the feel of a game of telephone, in which, from whisperer to whisperer, information is progressively mangled. The Boleyn sisters, who in life weren't close, are in Philippa Gregory's best-selling period romance, both subtle rivals and intimate co-conspirators. Morgan transforms them into total opposites, the famously promiscuous Mary, now a goody-good country girl with a demeanor that's vaguely Amish, the thoughtful Anne, now a Scarlett O'Hara type in brilliant green. Their conflict goes from a simmer to a boil, as Anne, now the green apple of the king's eye, visits her sister, bedridden with a precarious pregnancy.
Anne. I meant to come sooner. I'm sorry I did not. I've been kept occupied.
So I hear. Amusing the king.
Only that, sister, I assure you. Despite his best efforts.
What, not yours?
How is it?
The child is strong. He gives me no rest. Like his father.
Do you feel as awful as you look? You know, in France, no woman would allow herself to get in such a state.
Why did you come, Anne, if all you desire is to torment me?
Perhaps now you know how it feels. To be deceived by your sister.
I did nothing.
You stole the king away, and then you betrayed me over Henry Percy.
If that's what you think, fine, tell yourself that.
I did, sister. Every day and every night I was in exile.
As soap opera, The Other Boleyn Girl offers none of the kinky pleasures of Showtime's The Tudors, in which Jonathan Rhys-Meyers emits the kind of twisted pansexual vibe that could conceivably upend an empire. Eric Bana's Henry is a relative cipher, and the movie is all on the surface. But the pace is brisk, the lines have snap, and the feminist revisionism does have weight. And what of these young American actresses putting on British accents to vie for the king? They seem at first like co-eds in a college production of The Importance of Being Earnest. But once our dislocation fades, their Yankee gumption wins us over. For starters, they're so gorgeous they're worthy of oil paintings. When Henry studies Anne at prayer, the downy hairs on the back of her neck have a glow that's first angelic and then devilishly alluring. Portman gives the other Boleyn girl what it needs, a drama queen who grows on the scaffold into a real queen. Even more surprising, Scarlett Johansson pulls off Mary, a role that's a muddle of innocence and opportunism and dopey passivity, a potential career killer. But with no evidence strain, with almost everything internalized, Johansson makes sense of her character's contradictions. She keeps her head and makes you understand why Mary kept hers.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Finally, this just in from Springfield. Our very own Terry Gross will make her animated debut with Homer, Marge, Bart, and Lisa on the next episode of The Simpsons, appearing as a special guest voice. That's Sunday on The Simpsons on Fox.
Back now with Day to Day and back to Hollywood, where the Oscar hangovers are finally over and new movies are in theaters today. Mark Jordan Ligon is here with his weekly look at what the critics are saying, Slate's summary judgment.
Let's see. Will Ferrell has made comedies about soccer, NASCAR racing, and figure skating. And in his latest, Semi-Pro, he takes on professional basketball. Well, sorta. In the late 60s, the American Basketball Association rivaled the NBA until it got swallowed whole in 1976. Ferrell plays the owner of a struggling ABA franchise who has to figure out a way to build a winning team.
Let's try to win, but not win by too much.
Wait, we don't want to win by too much?
What?
See, if we score 125 points, that means we got to give everybody in here a free corn dog, right?
Yeah, sorry, Marks, we don't even got corn dogs.
The nation's critics pretty much want Semi-Pro to take extra laps around the gym. Even though Variety says it scores big laughs, the majority agree with the Minneapolis Star Tribune, erratic, overlong, and repetitive. And the Charlotte Observer complains, Jess Farrell doing the same man-boy shtick he usually does. Director Brett Morgan, whose last big screen effort was the Robert Evans documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture, now brings us Chicago 10. A blend of archival footage and animation that tells the story of the riotous 1968 Democratic National Convention and the trial that followed it. Some of the vocal talent includes Hank Azaria, Liev Schreiber, and Nick Nolte.
The government will prove the plan of the defendants who encouraged people to protest and riot.
The critics say, cool, man. The Washington Post raves, the first great film of 2008, audacious and ambitious. Entertainment Weekly calls Chicago 10 well worth seeing, and Film Threat says Morgan crafts a film as pertinent as ever. And if a silly sports comedy or a political cartoon documentary doesn't quite do it for you, how about a bodice-ripping historical drama? The Other Boleyn Girl tells the story of Anne and Mary Boleyn as they compete for Henry VIII's attention and the ultimate prize, marriage and becoming the Queen of England. Poor Eric Bana has to choose between Natalie Portman and Scarlett Johansson.
Please don't be angry with me. You think I desire to go for this purpose?
All I know is that a man that didn't know who you were was with you in that room for half an hour and came out besotted. Don't know what you said or did.
Nothing, sister, except sing your praises and talk about my husband.
Really? Well, you must show me how you did that sometime.
The critics are split, like a chopping block. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer likes it, shouting, an absorbing and exciting costume drama. But USA Today whines it's nothing but soap opera muck, and New York Magazine finds The Other Boleyn Girl a brisk feminist melodrama that is, historically speaking, a load of wank. Well, you know, every time this story is told, I feel poor King Henry gets a bum rap. Yeah, sure, he cut off Anne Boleyn's head. Sorry, dear listener, if I just spoiled a plot point, blame your history teacher. But it's only because he wanted a son to carry on the family dynasty. I can relate. The fact that there's no apparent male heir to the summary judgment throne, well, it does make one contemplate, and I'm sure my current wife understands. Oh, 'tis weary to be king.
Mark Jordan Ligon is a writer whose throne is right here in Los Angeles.
40 years ago, another presidential race was focused on an unpopular war. In 1968, the Democrats gathered for their convention in Chicago. They were met by demonstrators who had organized what they called a youth festival to protest the war in Vietnam. After several days of peaceful demonstrations, violence erupted. The police fired tear gas and clubbed demonstrators. A federal commission later called it a police riot. The protest leaders were arrested and put on trial together. They became known as the Chicago Seven. Now their story is the subject of an unorthodox documentary called Chicago 10. Bob Mondello has this review.
I'll get to that title inflation in a moment, but first let me just note that an era of convulsive political upheaval gets really interestingly animated, and I mean animated literally, in this documentary. Director Brett Morgan takes archival film of the protests outside the 1968 Chicago Convention, and he combines it with actors reading from court transcripts at the Chicago 7 trial, animating the action through a technique called motion capture.
Their plan was to bring people into Chicago to protest and then create a situation where these people would riot.
Motion capture is the animation technique where actors are filmed and then have their images digitally painted into virtual environments so that they seem like characters in a video game. In this case, you'll recognize some of the voices. Nick Nolte was the prosecutor in that scene, for instance. And as the camera swirls and whooshes around the courtroom, he and Liev Schreiber as a defense attorney and the late Roy Scheider as Judge Julius Hoffman engage in lots of what you'd have to call animated arguments.
Your Honor, we asked for 5 minutes 2 days ago, and you refused to give it to us.
You are shouting at the court.
Oh, Your Honor.
I've never shouted at you during this trial.
Your Honor, your voice has been raised, and several
you
times...
You have been disrespectful.
It is not disrespectful.
And sometimes, even worse than that, will you step off the witness stand?
He's just trying to calm us both down.
I needed no coming down.
Animation is a pretty hip way to recreate the circus-like atmosphere of the trial, where paper airplanes flew through the air, and there were plenty of other distractions. Defendant Jerry Rubin actually called the trial a cartoon at the time. But the historical footage that's mixed in with the courtroom scenes is sometimes just as amusing. Take this newscast about that very moment with a, shall we say, transcendentally challenged newscaster.
When an argument broke out between defense attorneys and the judge about an early recess, Ginsburg said, The judge got mad and kicked him out of the courtroom, and there was a running verbal battle down the court.
In fairness, meditation techniques weren't as well known in 1968 in the U.S. as they are now. As history, this movie leaves a good deal out, the name Hubert Humphrey, for instance, who became the nominee at the convention, and that title, Chicago 10, further confuses things. Before Black Panther Bobby Seale's case was separated from the others, the Chicago 7 was the Chicago 8, and director Brett Morgan thinks that because both of the defense lawyers were cited for contempt, they should be included too. With music by Rage Against the Machine and the Beastie Boys, Morgan is clearly trying for a younger audience than folks who actually remember the 60s, and it's in that context that the film works best, not as history, but as a sort of primer for activists on what happens when a passion for change is not being embraced by the political establishment. I'm Bob Mondello.
And here's a story of a romantic rivalry that would definitely have made the covers of celebrity magazines had they existed in 16th century England. The film The Other Boleyn Girl is based on Philippa Gregory's popular novel about an episode when Henry VIII was king and Anne Boleyn was looking to be his queen. LA Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has this review.
The Other Boleyn Girl has ideas above its station. It's not content to be a diverting royal bodice ripper, and so it spirals out of control into overwrought melodrama. Eric Bana, exercising his divine right to be a smoldering hunk, plays the king. Natalie Portman plays the flirtatious vamp Anne.
Good morning, Anne. Who will you ride with?
On my own, Your Grace. There's a new saddle now which allows this.
But with no man to hold on to, how do you propose to stay on the horse?
As you do, Your Grace. With my thighs.
This version of the tale emphasizes that it was Anne's kinder, gentler sister Mary, played by Scarlett Johansson, who was the first of the two Boleyn women to, as they say, share the king's bed, which really irritates Anne.
All I know is that a man that didn't know who you were was with you in that room for half an hour.
and came out besotted. Don't know what you said or did.
Nothing, sister, except sing your praises and talk about my husband.
Really? Well, you must show me how you did that sometime.
Anne was supposed to attract the king's attention first because her sister is already married. But Mary can't close the deal, and Anne has to be brought in from the bullpen, actually the royal court in France, to keep the king interested in the Boleyn family. With lots of pounding hoofbeats, flying banners, and royal stridings through stately halls, the other Boleyn girl gets points for color and pageantry, but lines like, "It costs a fortune to get this house ready for a royal visit," don't help things. And just when the other Boleyn girl should be picking up steam, the storytelling turns off-putting and glum. By the time Anne's fed-up sister tells her, "I've seen enough," we have as well.
Kenneth Duran reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. You can see a scene from The Other Boleyn Girl at npr.org/movies.
So 2 weeks ago today, 15-year-old Lawrence King, an openly gay eighth grader at Oxnard, California, at a school there, he was shot twice in the head, allegedly by his 14-year-old classmate. King was declared brain dead on Valentine's Day. Prosecutors are calling it a hate crime. The shooter had a history of bullying King because of his sexual orientation. Documentary filmmaker Deborah Chasnoff says a tragedy like this might have been avoided if gay tolerance was taught to all middle school kids, breaking down anti-gay bias before it can take hold. When it first aired nationally in 1998, her film, It's Elementary, talking about gay issues in schools, it sparked frank conversations about gays and lesbians in K-8 classrooms. Here's a clip from one student in the film.
Most of the time I put gays and lesbians down. I know it's not right, but I do it anyway. I say things like, gay men molest children, but that's not true. I say it all out of ignorance. I should find out what's true first before even saying anything about gays and lesbians.
Now, 10 years after its original release, It's Elementary is out again, re-released on DVD along with a new lesson plan for middle school teachers on gay tolerance. Yesterday, I spoke with Deborah Chasnoff about how tough it was to make that first film. Take us back to 1996 when you first did this film. What was the cultural context?
In the school environment, there was, we knew, a very high level of anti-gay harassment of students. And there was basically no awareness among educators about how homophobia affects children, and certainly zero motivation among 99% of educators in this country to do anything about it. And what we wanted to do was to issue a wake-up call and basically find ways to address prejudice, to prevent prejudice at the earliest age possible. And so we set off to make a film that would illuminate the problem and really inspire teachers and parents to take action in their school communities to begin to try to prevent anti-gay prejudice.
You started out trying to highlight cases of homophobia or how this wasn't being addressed in schools, and you ended up deciding instead to highlight work that was already being done by some educators on this issue. What had these people figured out that others hadn't at the time?
Well, I think they realized that children at any age are really capable of understanding some complex issues that I think leave adults, most adults, tongue-tied. And I think they also understood that there are age-appropriate ways at every grade in the kindergarten through 12th grade system that it is possible to end the complete and utter silence about lesbian and gay people, and that there are ways to integrate awareness of lesbian and gay issues and people and families into the everyday life of school.
You did receive some pushback.
Yeah. I mean, they basically, when they heard that we were making a film where we were going to film in their second or third or fourth grade classroom, where we were going to see a teacher leading a lesson that helped the students understand to respect lesbian and gay people, the administrators think, I need this like I need a gun to my head.
How do you talk to elementary school-aged kids about homosexuality?
It can start by reading a book in a classroom about a family where there are two moms or where there are, you know, two uncles who live together. There's lots of wonderful children's literature now that very matter-of-factly includes the fact that there are gay and lesbian people in families. Kids understand that. It's not a big deal to them. They get it. And in fact, the younger they are, the easier it is for them to understand it because they haven't absorbed all of the society's negative projections.
Why did you find it necessary to revisit the film 10 years later?
For one thing, we were going to be releasing It's Elementary on DVD for the first time, and we thought, well, we could just do that and make it available on DVD. But then we thought, well, why don't we use this decade of experience to revisit the cultural climate that existed in the mid-90s when we originally released the film and see what changed, and also to re-inspire a new generation of educators and parents to take action on this issue. And one of the things we had the opportunity to do is to go back and find some of the original students that happened to be in the classrooms where we filmed and see if they remember the lessons that we filmed and ask them what the impact was.
And what did you find through that process? Is this something that stayed with them?
Every single one of them has grown up to be a young adult who is an ally speaking out around anti-gay prejudice. Some of them went on to form a gay-straight alliance in their high school. One of them is a young man who now works in a middle school after-school program and finds he's coming up against young kids who, just like he did when we filmed, have very homophobic ideas, and he is now in a leadership role where he's helping them to understand that that's not the right way to go. And equally as poignant, I think, is the one young man who has turned out to be gay, and he is able to vividly remember the impact on him of having a teacher spend, you know, one class period out of the whole year talking about different kinds of name-calling and bullying, getting the class to focus and realize that it was not okay to tease someone because if you're a boy, you act like a girl. And he's able to pinpoint that having a teacher in elementary school do this kind of lesson helped create a safety net, safety base for him to be able to feel okay about himself and good about himself when he eventually came out.
Overall, is it fair to say that 10 years later, it's easier for gay students to come out to their families or friends at school? There are gay characters in pop culture, in television, that make it more acceptable and easier. Is that fair to say that it's easier?
I think our level of awareness as a society as a whole has increased dramatically. We're not as frightened by these issues, and we're more aware of the lesbian and gay people, and particularly the young people in our midst. You know, does it translate into a seventh grade teacher's willingness to incorporate information about lesbians and gay men when they do their regular class about stereotypes? Not necessarily. So I think our challenge and what we're hoping with the reissue of It's Elementary is that we can take our level of awareness and translate it into action that will really help a new generation of students.
What does it do to you, though, when you sit back and open the newspaper and read a story like the one just a couple of weeks ago, the Lawrence King case in Oxnard, California? I imagine that's frustrating for you.
When I heard about Lawrence King being murdered, I kept thinking about the young man who shot him. And I kept wondering to myself, what would have happened if he had been in an elementary school where, starting in first, second, or third grade, he had learned that there were lesbian and gay people and that in his community, and that it was important to respect them just as he would respect someone who was racially or ethnically different from him or from who spoke a different language. What would have happened if the cultural norm in his school community had been that lesbian and gay people are a valued and welcome members of our community? I really doubt he would have pulled a gun. It's a huge wake-up call to educators and parents that it really doesn't matter what any of us think at a personal level about gay and lesbian people. We owe it to our children to take proactive steps to combat this kind of prejudice.
Deborah Chasnoff is the director of It's Elementary, talking about gay issues in school. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
For more information on It's Elementary, talking about gay issues in school, check out our blog at www.npr/blogs, Bryant Park.
When it comes to movie catchphrases, there are the classics.
But it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. No, no. He's looking at you, kid.
Then there are the quotables.
You maniacs! You blew it up! Damn you! God damn you all to hell!
And for modern films, the catchphrase is often a product of the internet.
I have had it with these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane!
So what will be the film phrase of the past year that will grace T-shirts and worm its way into late-night monologues? It's a four-word sentence uttered with a melodramatic growl by this year's Oscar winner for Best Actor, Daniel Day-Lewis.
I drink your milkshake.
I didn't count the slurp. That line is from There Will Be Blood. It made it to SNL last week, and of course, with YouTube, means that there's a musical mashup. It had to be with Kelis.
I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours. Damn right, it's better than yours. I could teach you, but I have to charge. You want it.
Right now, milkshakes are having their moment. Killian Fox wondered about that in a blog post on The Guardian's website. So we rung him up to talk a little bit about it. Hi, Killian.
Hi there, Allison. How are you?
I'm well. So what do you think it is about I drink your milkshake that it has caught on?
I don't know. It's a very eye-catching little phrase. It's got that sort of lurid quality that bloggers on the internet seem to like. And it's also got the advantage of having the vehicle of an extremely good film to back it up.
The phrase itself is allegedly taken from congressional transcripts from the 20s Teapot Dome scandal, when a senator was convicted of accepting bribes for oil drilling rights to various lands. Now, according to the movie's writer, P.T. Anderson, the senator was asked to describe drainage before Congress, and the way he described it was, if you have a milkshake and I have a milkshake and my straw reaches across the room to your milkshake. So that's the history of how I drink your milkshake was used. Currently, how are people using it?
That's an interesting question. I'm sure in this sort of greedy and rapacious world that we live in, there are many opportunities to use this sort of line.
Do you think screenwriters can set out to write catchphrases? Can you actually create one?
Well, Paul Thomas Anderson seemed very surprised by the flurry of interest around this phrase. So I imagine these things work their way in unconsciously. I don't think they're necessarily dropped into a screenplay. I think people are just as surprised as we are.
Let's listen to a movie catchphrase that comes at a really pivotal point in the film. If this was never said, you wouldn't even understand the movie The Sixth Sense.
I see dead people.
Okay, of course, that was parodied into other films. One that said, I see black people. I believe that was one of the scary movies. What gives a phrase legs?
It's got to stand out from its context. It's got to be applicable to everyday life, I think. It's got to be something that jumps into your head whenever there's a certain situation. And the example you gave just there, I think, is a good one. I've heard hundreds of people use that line.
Do you think DVDs have had a hand in creating catchphrases?
Yeah, people will these days watch films 30 times over. An example that came up over and over again when I wrote my post on the Guardian website was The Big Lebowski.
I'm the dude.
Which clearly has a lot of fans who probably watch it every week by the sounds of it. And they've just endless quotes from that film. And that's clearly the result of watching and rewatching and rewatching. Yeah.
For a while, everywhere you went, we heard people attempting a Borat imitation.
Yetchimash! My name is Borat!
Can we follow her? And maybe make a sexy time with her?
No. Nice!
Very nice. I've heard that many, many times. And then, after a while, you hear it that one time too many.
Yeah.
What does it take to really spoil a catchphrase?
There's a certain cachet in good catchphrases. It's when it hasn't quite reached critical mass and when it's still a bit of a mystery, people kind of look at you slightly skew-ways, they don't quite know what you mean. That's when a catchphrase, I think, has its best effects, certainly from a selfish point of view. But once it just transfers and becomes completely common currency, and everybody says it. That's the point where it goes off the board, I think.
So I drink your milkshake is kind of in that moment. It's just at the right time. When you say it to the right person, they might smile or laugh. But
Certainly with the internet, these things are in grave danger of getting overexposed, I think, yes. And I think there could be a point where Paul Thomas Anderson is ruining ever putting that line in his screenplay.
All right. Well, I'm going to attempt to use it at some point during the rest of the show today. Killian Fox wrote about movie catchphrases in a blog post on the Guardian website. Thanks so much for weighing in and writing about the milkshake.
My pleasure.